One, two, three, Natalie!
Hi, welcome to the Personality Podcast. I'm your host, Natalie. Today's special guest is Stephen Coe. So Stephen is currently a trial attorney at the DOJ. He's also an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown, where he teaches international criminal law. Steve spent about 3 years in The Hague working at two different international criminal tribunals, and he has a killer resume. So Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so excited to have you here. So I'm curious, you have done so many like awesome stuff. You're very, very accomplished. I want to know, what do you do for fun? What do you do like when you're not working?
I guess I've played music my whole life. Mm. So growing up, I took piano lessons, but I guess even more relevantly, my father was and is a guitar player and singer. So when I was a kid, you know, after dinner in the summers and stuff, he'd pull out his acoustic guitar and play. So that maybe in some ways is even more the source of my musical love sort of thing.
Oh.
And so when I was younger, I played in a rock band in high school. And then when I was in college and in grad school, I sang in the choir. I was pretty involved. When I was at Harvard, I was in the Harvard Glee Club, and we took a tour of Scandinavia and Russia.
Oh, cool.
But now that I'm older, it's mostly just me playing acoustic guitar and singing by myself.
Yeah.
So that's the main thing I would say I do for, well, one of the main things I do for fun is working on my performance. When I lived in Europe, I played open mics more, but I'm still doing personal recordings and just things for fun.
Yeah.
And then other than that, I go to CrossFit DC, so I do a lot of CrossFit. I know one of your previous guests talked a lot about that.
Yeah.
I guess it's another thing I do for fun.
Yeah. Do you ever get nervous when you perform?
So it's interesting. I always, it's very actually similar to CrossFit, and it's very similar to lecturing, which is the worst part is the day or the hours or even the minutes before.
Yeah.
And then within 30 seconds of being up there, I feel totally relaxed, more relaxed than I feel doing anything else, basically.
Oh.
Which is a feeling that you almost start to chase after a while, that feeling of like total tranquility.
Yeah.
So like I think I almost kind of come alive when I'm behind a microphone or behind a podium.
Yeah.
And again, I do think it's pretty similar feeling. So.
Huh. So it seems like the nerves go away once you start like getting in your zone.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. And I get energy from being in front of people. So I worked in The Hague for 3 years, as you mentioned. And usually when people leave The Hague, they send an email out and say, oh, please come to this bar at this time, and I'm going to have a little goodbye party and this sort of thing. Instead, I organized a goodbye concert. So there was an intern that I knew who was the opening act. I was the second act. And this other band I knew closed, and they were fantastic. So it was really kind of like a farewell concert sort of thing. And I just loved that feeling of being able to say goodbye to people in that way.
Yeah.
Create an event, which was really fun. Yeah, do it in a way that felt energized.
Yeah. So. I should mention for our listeners, so I asked Steve to send me a song that I could use for the transition music. And so you'll be hearing his music throughout this episode, which is very cool, I think. So then going back to like kind of your lecturing, can you walk me through what was the first day like for you when you first taught? It was recently, right?
Yeah. So I was a guest lecturer last year at Georgetown. I gave about a third of the lectures in international criminal law in their class. And the first class, I was just completely petrified.
Were you?
Yeah. So I thought I would be kind of unmasked as a fraud, because in my heart, I still feel often like a total amateur.
Yeah. Wait, and how old are you?
I'm 33.
Yeah, 33, teaching law. Okay,
And I graduated from law school, I guess, 7 years ago now. So when I came in, I just thought I'd be completely unmasked as this fraud, and the students would know that I didn't know what I was doing. So I really prepared hard. And another thing that made it challenging was it was my first time lecturing based on a casebook, based on pre-assigned reading.
Yeah.
Because up until then, I just kind of done a visiting thing. And we're both Cornell law alumni. Yeah. I went back to Cornell a couple of years ago, but I just kind of showed up and just spoke to the students about international legal careers. There was no preparation for the students, and I wasn't responsible for teaching any material.
Yeah.
But at Georgetown, there was a casebook, there was reading. It was, the first one was Nuremberg and the International Criminal Tribunals.
Yeah.
But again, I had that feeling after about 30 seconds of feeling completely comfortable. Mm. And the students really enjoyed it. I told a lot of war stories.
Mm.
And it made me realize, actually, that contrary to my kind of gut feeling, I have grown a lot in the past 7 years, and
yeah,
there is some experience and knowledge I can draw from that students don't necessarily have.
Yeah.
So there's something very cathartic about that experience.
Yeah. Has anyone ever told you that you kind of sound like Obama?
Yeah, people tell me that pretty frequently.
Yeah, I didn't realize until like just listening to you now. I'm like, oh my God, he like kind of sounds like Obama.
Yeah, it's actually funny. One of my friends told me relatively recently, he said, Steve, I think you've been listening to too many Obama interviews because you're starting to adopt his mannerisms.
You are, yeah.
But actually, it's the inverse. So when he first exploded onto the scene,
yeah,
like my grandmother, for example, sent an email to the family saying, doesn't this guy remind you of Steve? So people, and it was even exacerbated more when I lived abroad because, you know, the way I move my body, the way my inflections are just American.
Yeah.
So it was even more obvious to people when I was in Europe.
Yeah. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to ask you about today was kind of your interesting background.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve is half Lebanese, half Korean, and you are actually the only person I know who fits into that category. I was curious if you identify with one side more than the other.
The simple answer is no, but the longer answer is I engage with both sides a little differently.
How so?
Well, I grew up in my mother's town. So my mom grew up in a town in Massachusetts called Andover, and that's where I grew up as well. My mother's side of the family were Lebanese immigrants in 1895 and 1905, respectively. So I think of myself as being of that community and having grown up with, you know, Lebanese American grandparents and being a part of that culture on a kind of day-to-day basis. And there's something about the kind of love and warmth of growing up with relatives from that side that I find really strikes to the core of who I am.
Yeah.
On the Korean side, it's a little different. First of all, the immigration is a little more recent. So my grandparents came to the U.S. in the 1940s.
Hmm.
My grandfather came for graduate legal studies and my grandmother came as an undergraduate. And so my father was raised by two Korean immigrants and therefore had a much more kind of direct engagement with Korean values. I'm also the oldest grandson.
Uh-huh.
So there's this word in Korean, Changsom, which means the oldest son of the oldest son.
Yeah.
So I think that's given me a sense of orientation in that cultural space a little more explicitly. Also, I lived in Korea for 6 months. I had a little time off from a law firm. And so I chose to go to Korea for 6 months as a visiting scholar at this law school called Seoul National University Law School. And there I had a very direct engagement with Korea.
Yeah. What'd you think?
I mean, I loved it. Yeah.
It was
one of the best decision I ever made. Just going there, living there. I live with a host family. I had Korean friends. I gave a lecture in law. And, you know, I always say the paradox of going to your family homeland is you discover things that are already inside of you.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask, like, what Korean aspects do you see in yourself?
I remember having this lightning bolt moment. After being in Korea for a couple months, I said, you know, there's something about a lot of the values in this country that sync up so well with who I am. So Koreans on the whole, for I guess historical reasons, see the legal profession, see law as kind of pretty high.
Yeah.
They also care a lot about education, English language. On the whole, I would say they also have a sense of appreciation for the U.S. And they also have a lot of respect for teachers and for professors.
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, wow, I'm so suited for the values in this country.
Yeah.
What a coincidence.
Yeah.
And then I realized it wasn't a coincidence. The reason why I am the way I am is because of both sides of my family, but you know, one of those sides is Korean and it comes from the values that my grandparents introduced and my father raised me with.
Yeah. What do people usually think you are ethnically?
I've been asked my whole life, and I decided a long time ago that because I'm going to be asked this my whole life, I'm going to do some research. So I always ask people back, what do you think I am?
Oh, what's the best answer you've gotten to that?
Because most people say, I think you're some kind of Asian. But one time I told a girl, oh, I'm half Korean, half Lebanese. And she said, really? I can see the Lebanese, but I can't see the Korean at all.
That's so funny.
So what I realized, it's all kind of in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've gotten Greek, Mexican, Native American.
Yeah.
And I tend to blend in. I was in Peru for work last month.
Uh-huh.
I felt like I was just walking through the street. I didn't necessarily pop out at people in the same way that I might, you know, if I were blonde-haired, blue-eyed.
Yeah. You mentioned your family quite a bit. So your dad played guitar and he kind of instilled that in you. What do you think are some other values that he's instilled in you?
I would say basically all my values. He and my mom and I guess my grandparents' generation as well. There are two real rock solid things in my family. Maybe three, I would say. One is a strong commitment to education. Mm-hmm. That's something that we've always stressed in my family. And my brother, sister, and I think of all pursued education pretty intensely. That's the first one. The second one is a strong commitment to family. My dad and my mom really are both very close to their families. And we grew up in a really happy household, which made a huge difference, of course, in our lives. And then finally, my parents raised us to be as thoughtful as possible about the responsibility of our education and our upbringing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my dad and both my parents are physicians, but they've approached it in kind of different ways. My mom's an eye surgeon. So for her whole life, she's helped people to see in a very concrete way. Yeah. Whereas my dad has ultimately done public health, which is more policy. It's more, how do we promote health in a more holistic way? Everything from clean air, clean water, you know, skin cancer screenings, not smoking. And my father also has done work in government. So he was the commissioner of public health for the government of Massachusetts, for the commission of public health. And then he was also in the Department of Health and Human Services as one of the assistant secretaries. So this legacy of public service is something that I think the three, my two siblings and I, have also kind of internalized. You know, what do you do with your education? What do you do with all the blessings that you've had? You can do a lot of things, and you can do things for society not in your career. I know some people have approached it that way. They're going to do whatever they want to sustain themselves and then volunteer or other things. But I think the three of us feel like we should hit it head on.
So you are the eldest of three.
Right.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your siblings.
I have one younger brother and one younger sister. Okay. And we have something shared between us that brothers just have.
Yeah.
Between the two of them, they know everything about me.
Wow.
You know, we're really close and we've always been. My brother, we went to the same high school, college, and then he went to business school. And right out of business school, he did a leadership. He was a leadership fellow for the mayor of Boston.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So my brother is now chief of staff to the mayor of Boston.
Yeah.
And he's doing a fantastic job. He loves it. He loves the city. He loves the mayor. And again, I think he's really trying to live that message of public service. My sister, you know, she and I are also extremely close. I mean, she's, you know, maybe one of the best people I've ever known in my life. And she's a second year resident in psychiatry. She's a physician.
Mm-hmm.
But her whole life, she's gravitated towards needy populations. Mm-hmm. So in college, she worked in the homeless shelter. That's the only student-run homeless shelter in the country. And she's done a lot of work with Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, helping the homeless population in Boston. So I'm very proud of her.
Mm. I am my mother on the wall.
Who controls the radio or the music or whatever you guys are doing?
We usually drive with the radio off. So that's actually another joke between me and my siblings, is I'm always excited about a certain song. There's always something I'm very into at the time.
Yeah.
And so I'm always trying to get my brother and sister like listen to something in the car. And usually for whatever reason, they don't enjoy it. So it's always like everyone's are like turning it off. And I'm the one who's trying to like play something to share. You know? But I'm always going back to these songs like constantly.
Yeah.
And people know that I'm usually on about something at the time.
What are you like crazy about right now?
I listened to NPR's All Songs Considered Best Albums of 2015.
Ah.
And I discovered through that this country artist, Kacey Musgraves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like I'm a couple of years late to this.
Yeah. Party,
but she just came out with a new album this year.
Yeah.
She's so talented. And I realize when I'm listening to music, I'm looking for some feeling of emotional sincerity. And that's something that I think doesn't necessarily come through with all artists. With her, somehow, she's kind of playful and there's something that's kind of light. And it is a little bit poppy.
Yeah.
It's very poppy. But there's still something there that feels very real. And that's what I'm intrigued by with her right now. So that's what I'm listening to. Dime Store Cowgirl.
Oh. We're going to send this podcast to her, by the way.
Okay.
Oh, great, yeah. We're going to try to meet her.
All right. Great, great.
Okay. So do you do this for your own songs, too? Do you feel like you try to be emotionally like open yourself?
Yes.
Yes.
I want people to feel... So first of all, I'm a total amateur and I'm very...
We'll let our listeners decide that.
I'm very self-conscious talking about it because I think I'm never really satisfied with my performances or my recording, but the way I've described it is kind of like picking up an object from a table. You should pick it up in one motion. And when you see a performer performing, you should experience one thing. You shouldn't see the guy fiddling with the mic, fiddling with his guitar, looking down at his guitar, not really knowing how to play it, not knowing the notes of the song. You should just have one experience, one kind of holistic experience. Mm-hmm. I would say that's what I'm going for when I perform. And whether or not I succeed at that or not is for the audience to decide. But I want people to feel like they experienced something strong and kind of whole.
So you're very hard on yourself with your music.
Yeah, people have told me that before. You know, it's like John Lennon used to hide under tables when songs were played back in the recording studio. Oh. And he always used to ask the producer, George Martin, to double track his vocals, do weird things to his vocals because he hated his voice. And I'm obviously like, you know, less than 1% of the vocalist that John Lennon is. But I kind of know that feeling, which is just this feeling of you listen to it back and you just hear all these things you could have done differently.
Oh. Are you as hard on yourself with work as you are with your music?
I think so. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm writing law articles.
Yeah, every time I see you, Steve, you have like a new publication going on. I'm like, how is this guy doing this?
I'm always writing on the side, and I always feel like it could be better.
Yeah.
And I actually had an interesting conversation with a friend, another lawyer friend, about this.
Hmm.
I told her, I feel like you've found contentment in life.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of jealous of you in a way. Yeah. I said that obviously in like a friendly way.
Yeah.
And she said, that might be true, but I feel like that's been at the expense of restlessness or ambition or something like that.
Yeah.
And it made me realize there's that sort of trade-off for people. So the good news is it always kind of pushes me to do more or try to keep raising my game.
Yeah.
But the bad news is you always feel like there's another level that you can hit.
Oh.
I think that's the trade-off that I feel.
Wow. How often, percentage-wise, do you think you're like content just overall?
That's a great question. It just throughout my day?
Yeah.
That's a great question. I would say not that often.
Not that often.
You know, I know you asked this as a set question, but, you know, in my morning, the first thing I'm doing when I wake up in the morning is trying to get out of my apartment so I can hit some coffee shop and do writing for about an hour before I go to work. So from the moment I wake up, I'm kind of, you know, trying to work. And then I get to work. And, you know, my work is, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on there. And then I get home, I'm doing all these different things. So when I think of moments of true contentment,
yeah,
I think of these really wonderful moments I've had with friends or when I've been away, when I've been on vacation. Mm. And everything has to line up. You know, I'm with a friend I haven't seen in a long time. We're at a restaurant. We feel good. Mm. We're having good food. Mm. We're catching up. We're happy to be with each other.
Mm.
But yeah, I think that's pretty fleeting.
Yeah.
I need to think about that question more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad that you use the word content because I think a lot of people in our society are striving for happiness.
Right.
Like when I ask them, like, what do you want in life? People are like, I just want to be happy.
Exactly.
And I agree with that on a certain level. But for me personally, I'd rather have a well-rounded life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't really experience happiness or know true happiness unless you have had moments of sadness or loneliness. And, you know, I think it's important to have kind of every side of it. But contentment is, it's just kind of like being at peace with
right,
everything.
Right, exactly. There's a feeling of tranquility with contentment.
Yeah.
Like everything is just the way it should be.
Yeah, yeah. Know?
And that's different from happiness.
Yeah.
Right.
When's the last time you experienced that level of contentment?
I had a friend visiting from Europe. We just had lunch. It was pretty quick.
Yeah.
He was just in town for 36 hours.
Yeah.
Even less, 24 hours. But it was great. I mean, you know, we hadn't seen each other in a few months. And there was just something so complete about being there and just catching up. And
yeah,
that was a feeling of contentment.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's great when you meet people like that and you connect with them.
Right.
I totally identify with that. Like you haven't seen someone in a long time and you're just catching up on life and it's
right.
So great.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think a lot of feelings of contentment come from that feeling of being with other people or one other person.
Yeah.
And you just feel like it's all where it should be.
Yeah. Now you know. So before we started the recording, we were talking about our Myers-Briggs. and you are ENFJ.
Right.
So I was surprised that you were an F because most guys are T's.
That's correct.
Yeah. But you're a feeler.
I guess, I mean, yeah, I am.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that they say about feelers is that they're very values driven.
Yeah.
So I remember when I was first getting into the test, one of my friends sent it to me when I was living in The Hague. And I just took it for fun, being kind of dismissive of it. ENFJ is parent.
Parent.
Yeah. And it was read exactly the way I think of myself as going to be when I'm a father.
Really?
Yeah, just really preoccupied first and foremost with raising my children with good values, to be good people, you know, their biggest cheerleader, but also, you know, having very high standards for them and all those sorts of things. And so much of that comes with being F, I think.
Mm-mm.
People who are F tend to be really values driven and really, you know, they're kind of gut driven.
Yeah.
I guess I think of myself that way. Yeah, you know, I have friends who are much better debaters than I am.
Yeah.
And I think of them as being more T in that sense.
Yeah.
But when it comes to really believing with my soul or whatever, I think of that as being more of an F or an NF kind of combination characteristic.
Yeah. So you were mentioning that some of the things that you would like to do as a parent is instill certain values and be their biggest cheerleader. What kind of values do you want to instill into them?
The same three values that I was raised with. So I remember telling my dad once when I was a kid, I think of myself as this intergenerational conduit.
Mm-hmm.
My goal is to just pass the values of my family down to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can do that half as well as my parents did, then I'll be pleased with that.
Mm-hmm.
And my father said, your grandmother would be very happy to hear you say that because that's such a Korean thing to say.
It is, yeah.
But I think of myself that way. I'm my grandmother told me once that I'm the 34th generation of Ko. You know, Koreans have kept records of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is just to kind of do as well as I can and pass that on to the next generation.
Mm.
Keep them family-oriented, education-oriented, and have them be good people who are thoughtful about their lot in society.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Just going back to the feeler thing. So
right.
Are there things that like kind of pull at your heartstrings? Like when you watch something or see something?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know one of the questions on the personality test is, do you easily get engaged by soap operas? You know? And I like never watch soap operas, but it's very easy for me if I'm just in a movie or, you know, walking by someone's television set. I mean, there's a very emotionally engaging scene.
Yeah.
To feel emotionally engaged.
Oh, you know? So like it draws you in.
It draws me in. Yeah, it draws me in. But somehow I do think of myself as really emotionally engaged when I'm experiencing art. You know.
And what about your E side? So I'm not surprised by this at all. I think of you as a very social person.
Right.
You have like a billion friends. How do you make time for all of your friends?
I mean, I do the best I can. I don't think of myself as so popular. I think of myself as having a really core group of inner friends where I'm always available to them and they're usually always available to me. And that's my kind of touching off point. In addition to my family, of course.
Yeah.
And then everyone outside of that, I just do the best I can. How do you do it? I feel like you also have a lot of friends.
Yeah, I think it's really about two things, like making time. You have to make the time. I'm really big in person, on the phone, engaging, and then getting to know that person, what they like, what motivates them. And it could be it's like deep stuff, right? Like kind of like some of the sad stuff that they've gone through to like, you know what I mean? Like what's their favorite like ice cream flavor? I think doing those two things. But I think the time thing is something that gets harder as we get older and
right.
There's so many like pressures on our time.
Right.
But you really have to like make the time and just
yeah,
do
it's
it.
A proactive decision.
Yeah, it's proactive. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How would your friends describe you, Steve? The core circle that you talked about, how would they describe you?
William James has this quote, "A man has as many social selves as there are those who know him." I love that quote because different friends would describe me slightly differently.
Ah.
I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, my friends from college would think of me as the one who, you know, of my roommate group, for example. I think they'd probably say, well, I'm the one who brings a certain lightness or kind of joie de vivre.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah. And when I'm with those guys, I feel that way.
Okay.
100%.
Yeah.
Then my friends from Cambridge, because I got my master's after college, I think they would describe me as more cerebral. And kind of interested in philosophy and culture and history and these sorts of things. Because so much of what I did during that year was having those conversations.
Mm.
It was my first year abroad. And, you know, my best friends were from, you know, like I mentioned, my German friend already, friends from Spain and Egypt and all these places. In law school, my friends from law school, I guess, would describe me as kind of studious. So there's one friend who knows me and my two siblings. And he's one of the few people I think of who had direct engagement with all three of us, one-on-one, in different contexts.
Yeah. You know?
I asked him once, what is it that you think unites all three of us?
That's a great question.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, enthusiasm for life. It's boundless. You know, which I thought was such an interesting answer. So I think most people would think of me as that way. Heartfelt and really going for it in life.
Yeah. Why did you think it was an interesting answer when he said that?
I don't think of that as necessarily the first thing that distinguishes us from others. But then when I take a step back, I guess I can see that. I mean, one of my colleagues is always joking with me that I'm always amazed whenever we do anything in the office because I'm seeing international law work or, you know, if I'm performing music, how I sing with gusto or these sorts of things. Mm. And, you know, I see my brother and my sister, they're really, we all love to laugh and we all love to make people feel good about themselves. And so it doesn't seem to me when I'm first thinking about the three of us that's what makes us distinctive.
Yeah.
You know, or that unites us necessarily.
Yeah. You know, so. Touching on this kind of idea of laughing, what do you do to cheer yourself up if you're down?
One is I go to the gym.
Oh, endorphins.
Endorphins. And especially, you know, CrossFit DC, which is where I go, it's a great community. And I always come away feeling better 100% of the time. And that's a pretty rare thing. You know, in life, you don't get 100% with almost anything. But it's a combination of being around these people that I really like to be around and then getting a great workout, usually high intensity. There's something about that combination that just immediately snaps me out. And it's almost similar to meditation in a way. I'll come into the class feeling completely distracted by all the things that have gone on the day. And then at the end of the hour, to be able to just disconnect from your work stresses for that amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then when it does return after that hour, you just don't feel like it's as severe. You know? The other thing, again, is just engagement. You know, if I play some music, I record something, I read something, a film that I find particularly moving, I find that so rejuvenating. Mm. So I guess that's the other thing.
Well, you know, it's so funny because I asked that question to a lot of people and a lot of people, they respond with like, yeah, I go out and do something. And I'm thinking, what? Like, when I'm like really down, my thought is not like, oh, I need to get out. I'm like, oh, I just want to like shut the world out and like not do anything.
Right.
So it's interesting how people kind of respond to that kind of circumstance.
Yeah. For me, any sort of isolation just makes me feel worse.
Yeah.
So if I'm isolated from people or isolated from things that I enjoy, like if I could never listen to the Beatles catalog again.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be depressed about it for the rest of my life. So there's something about engagement that makes me feel better.
Yeah.
Just engaging with things, with people.
What's the best concert you've ever been to?
I saw Radiohead in Rome a few years ago, and it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I hadn't been listening to them that proactively, and it just completely blew me away. Also, I saw Taylor Swift this year with my siblings.
Yeah.
1989 tour.
Oh, yeah.
And we had great seats, and I absolutely loved it. I was on such a high.
Yeah.
I mean,
Wait, which city were you in?
In Boston.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you see her hair?
Yeah. It was amazing.
It was amazing, right?
Yeah. I went with my sister, actually, and we just... she's so talented.
So talented.
I mean, she just killed it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said to my siblings beforehand, that it's kind of like seeing the Beatles in 1964. I mean, Taylor Swift's arguably the number one artist of the past 12 months. And to be seeing her on that tour at the top of her game, the whole production, but then also the way she really directly connects with audiences.
Yeah.
And people love her. I mean, people in the audience just like love, you know, everyone had like her lyrics on their shirts and right before the concert started, people were doing the wave.
Yeah.
Did they do that?
Yeah.
I couldn't get over that.
Yeah.
I was like,
I know her fans are like such like true diehard fans.
Yeah. It's like,
but she's so good to her fans too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. She's sending them Christmas gifts and stuff.
Yeah.
There was an article recently, I think it was by this guy, like Chuck Klosterman, but he talked about how she's really unique and has achieved the success as a woman. And she hasn't had to do a lot of things that other women have been forced to do by the industry. You know, she has a very clean image and she writes all her songs and she's done all these amazing things. Do you think she's a genius?
You know, that's not the first word that I would use to describe her. I guess in a way she is. I think she is so magnetic. And I think of her as kind of genuine,
right,
which I think is so hard in her industry.
Right.
I just feel like she's very sincere in what she does. And she lets it out there, and her relationship with her mom and everything. But I remember when I was at that concert, I'm not really an envious person, but I was like, oh, if I could just be her for one day and just experience that feeling of all those people watching you and just performing, like going back to what we were saying.
It must be incredible.
Incredible. Yeah. Like just being part of that crowd was such an experience. But imagine if you were the focus of that and just draw this energy, and to be able to inspire and connect on such a global scale is just
incredible.
Incredible. Yeah.
Something George Harrison said was the Beatles always felt when they rose to fame that at least they had each other, whereas Elvis was alone. And that was something that what you just said reminded me of. That is when Taylor Swift's on the stage, you know, okay, I guess people are looking at the dancers, but basically people are 100% there to see her.
Yeah.
And it's all about her.
It's all about her.
I just can't imagine that that experience.
Yeah. Maybe one day. You're a little bit closer to that than I am. So. So going back to the friend stuff that you're talking about, you were saying how, you know, people describe you a little bit differently depending on the circle.
Right.
What's one thing that you wished your friends knew more about you?
I'm pretty on the surface with people, friends and non-friends. So I don't think of myself as having a lot that's really buried that I haven't expressed. And I think that that's also something that comes with being a more people-oriented person is a lot of the times the way I think through an issue is by talking to people about it. Or if I'm really excited about something, I'll just talk to people about it. Going back to being with friends and feeling that sense of contentment, I wish my friends had been there with me or could kind of know all the different experiences I've had in different countries. Because it can be very hard to convey these lived experiences, especially cross-culturally.
Yeah.
So, for example, living in Korea for 6 months and, you know, being in the same law school where my grandfather studied and taught law. That was such a profound experience, such a profound feeling. It's hard to convey that unless you're physically there, physically, you know, staring at the portraits on the wall.
Tell me a little bit about your time in The Hague, what you were doing there and your experience there.
So I lived there for 3 years, and I started by working at the International Criminal Court, first as a visiting professional, then on a contract basis. And then I switched to this other war crimes tribunal run by the United Nations. So I spent a total of 3 years there. The simple way to put it, I guess, is these courts are aimed at prosecuting people or, you know, putting people on trial for the most serious crimes. And those are usually three: genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The idea is that these crimes are so serious, you know, you can think of them as kind of, you know, the Third Reich in the 1930s and 40s, genocide. These crimes are so serious that the international community should be involved in prosecuting them, no matter where they are. So I loved it. I often say, you know, I wandered into The Hague with a strong but still very abstract interest in international law. I came away with 3 years of very hard practice experience. And it changed my life. There's the idealism of being there. I mean, you really feel when you're there that these courts are aspiring to change the world by providing accountability for these crimes and ultimately preventing these crimes. And then you also feel a tremendous sense of connection with others. So you meet other idealists. You know, my team, for example, at the UN War Crimes Tribunal, our team leader was French. You know, my colleagues were from Sri Lanka / Australia, Bosnia / Holland. They're both dual nationals, you know, Croatia, Japan, Mexico. And the judges I worked for were from different countries as well. So it's this amazing feeling of working with people from around the world towards this goal. It was incredible.
Yeah. Wow. Tell me about the people that you kind of interacted with when you were in The Hague. I feel like it must attract a certain type or types of personalities?
Yeah, the main type of personality is people who are really big picture, global thinkers and idealists. you know, it's a city that's high on ideals. Like The Hague calls itself the city of international peace and justice. Yeah. And you, so you have these lawyers, the ones I was interacting with most obviously were younger lawyers like me, who were in their respective countries, studied law, passed the bar, most of them by that point, but wanted to do something that was global, that they felt was making a global difference. So you found yourself meeting people and immediately feeling a connection with them because they were kind of similar to you. Mm-hmm. It's almost kind of like a self-selection into a certain world. And it didn't just end with law. I mean, you know, we had amazing conversations about all sorts of things. And I think maybe that's where some of the personality stuff comes in as well. You know, if you're an idealist, you're more attracted to big picture things. You can also have big picture discussions about things other than law. So a lot of my conversations with people about music or literature were also really great.
Yeah.
I liked that law was real. It was tangible. Mm-hmm. It could make a difference locally, nationally, internationally. Mm. You know, at the end of the day, the project of international law is trying to promote a sense of justice in the world. Yeah. And there's something so real about that.
Do you have any life or career mentors?
Yeah, the main ones, the first ones I think of are in my family.
Yeah.
As I mentioned before, my grandfather was a professor of international law and my uncle as well. Even though my grandfather passed away when I was young, his example and then my uncle's mentorship has really helped. But even my parents who are not in law have really given me amazing guidance every step of the way through my life. I mean, I just feel like incredibly lucky. I feel like I have so many mentors. I don't even know how to get into it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had a common professor in law school. Mm-hmm. You know, he could kind of sense in me way back in the day that I was interested in international law. And he really was a great mentor. And we talked a lot. And when I went back to the law school recently, we had dinner. He's like a fantastic person.
Yeah.
But yeah, mentors, I think, you know, I feel lucky I've had a lot.
Yeah. That's good that you surround yourself with people who will like help you along the way.
Right.
I think that's so good to have kind of inspiration and guidance where you could get it.
Yeah, now I find myself, the wheel is starting to turn. So I find myself starting to give advice to people.
Yeah.
At first felt so surreal. Now it's becoming more common.
Yeah.
But I'm really trying to do as good a job with it as I can because
I think you're doing a great job. I mean, the way I met you was through that professor and because I was interested in
working
at the tribunal.
Yeah.
And you were so helpful. I reached out to you. You didn't know me. And I was I'm interested in working in the court. And then we had a call and I thought, oh, this guy is so great. Like, I really appreciate people who like take the time out and just lend a hand.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Oh. Yeah. No, thank you.
That's good to hear.
Oh. Yeah. I really appreciate that. I always remember that. And, you know, whenever someone reaches out to me now, I always just think, pay it forward.
One of the questions I ask people a lot, which is maybe a good podcast question.
Yeah, ask me.
Is if you could live 100 lives, how many would you live as a lawyer in your case? And how many would you live as other things? And what would those other things be?
Oh, this is a great question. Yeah. I'm totally going to add it to the repertoire.
Yeah, yeah. And you have to choose now. So you sound like sometimes people say, oh, well, I tried living one life as a professional violinist and then I'd see how it goes sort of thing.
So for me, I would want to be a dancer.
What type of dancer?
Like hip hop.
Okay. So just one life as a hip hop dancer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And not as like ballet or...
Ballet. You know, it'd be cool to do like a cross ballet hip hop something.
Okay.
Oh, I think I would love to be a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just like learn about people and like...
I can see that.
Yeah. What makes them tick. And oh, and then I would want to be an athlete. A professional tennis player.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would like to be.
And why? Because you play tennis now or because you've never played, but you think it would be great?
I played in high school and I play a little bit now. Yeah, I would just love to like be at the top of my game, physical fitness wise, you know?
Right.
And then just.
And just see how it goes.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I think it'd be great to be like a National Geographic photographer and just travel the world.
Yeah.
And take amazing photographs. I'd want to be like a filmmaker. You know what I mean? Like actually make movies to like inspire people.
So the nice thing with 100 lives, you know, you could choose one life to that, one life to the
other. Yeah, yeah.
But what I like about the question is that it teases out the implicit interest in people.
Yeah.
With 10 lives, you really have to hoard them.
Right.
You know, with 100, you have enough that you can say, well, you know, I'd devote one one of my lives to just, I don't know, living in some canal boat in Amsterdam and just seeing what happened.
Yeah. You know, I used to be more like that. I used to be more like, oh, I'll just like live abroad somewhere and like kind of see how it goes. But now as I've gotten older, I want to have like more purpose and meaning of my life rather than just like aimlessly like going from place to place.
Right. Some sort of direction.
Yeah. Doing something where I felt like I'm actually contributing something. Before I moved to Hong Kong, like I'd always been searching to like live abroad. I've lived abroad before, but not worked really abroad. And that was kind of, I've been searching for this. And then I got what I wanted. And I lived the life that exactly how I wanted to live it. Met such interesting people, new people, traveled around and experienced new things. But I didn't feel content with my life at the end. That's and so thing. I knew that I had to come back. What would you do with your 100 other lives?
Well, it's as you were answering, I realized that people usually don't ask me back because we start talking and then we go off. So I actually haven't really systematically thought about it. But one of the thoughts I had recently is I devote one life to each of the instruments, you know, tenor, sax, cello, oboe.
Oboe, even the oboe?
I like very, very briefly
play the oboe
lessons in high school just because I love the sound.
You do.
Yeah, it has a particular sound. It's different from the clarinet.
Yeah, no, I'm familiar
are you
with
an
the
oboe player?
No. But like I sat next to the oboe player in
right,
orchestra.
Right, you play flute. Right?
Yeah. And it's a very distinct sound.
Yeah, it's very distinct.
Yeah.
So I just love to, at least a solid handful of orchestral instruments, and then I would definitely devote at least one life to just seeing how far I could go as like a rock musician.
Yeah.
Even though I'm 99.9% positive it would be a disaster because I don't have what it takes. It would just be. It would just be great to scratch that itch.
Yeah.
100%.
Right. What is your end goal for your career? What would you like?
I'd like to be a trilingual professional, I think. And what I mean by that is not actually trilingual. When my dad was introduced once by the dean of his school, someone called him a trilingual professional. He can speak the language of patient care as a doctor. He can speak the language of academics, and he can speak the language of government and policy.
Huh.
So I'd like to do that. I mean, right now I'm kind of straddling the line as best I can between being a government attorney and being a teacher and a scholar. So I think that's my aspiration, to always kind of be in that in-between zone.
Yeah.
Where I'm a little bit academic for the practitioners, and I'm a little bit practice-oriented for the academics.
Got it.
And hopefully bridge that gap as best I can. Again, my father's done this, my uncle, my grandfather, a lot of people in my family. So that's usually what I think. And again, just trying to promote justice as best I see it, you know,
yeah.
Throw myself into debates and try and push for the values that I think are right. So.
Yeah. So moving on to the set questions that I ask all my guests. So Steve, what is a pet peeve of yours?
People who too quickly dismiss country music.
Oh, yeah.
And growing up in Massachusetts in New England, there was one country music station. And most people would make the same comments about country music. One is, oh, I listen to all sorts of music, except country.
Yeah.
But I clerked for a year in Texas, and I lived in Houston. And there's like five country music stations. I listened to a ton of country music.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, it has so much. Did you listen to country?
So I used to be one of those people that said that.
Right.
Like, but then my sophomore year of college, our college, you had to be on campus during the summer.
Uh-huh.
So this is what
right. Sophomore
yeah,
summer.
Yeah, at Dartmouth. And my roommates and friends, they like all were listening to country music. And I just listened the whole summer
right.
to that. And then my roommates were like, you have to stop because I would just put the songs on repeat.
So you got into it?
Oh, yeah. Oh. Totally got sucked into it.
Good.
Yeah. I have so many fond memories of like driving around campus that summer, listening to country music with the windows rolled down.
Right.
And
yeah, for me, it's in a way, it's kind of symbolic for some of the problems we have in the U.S.
Yeah.
People kind of dismiss. I think there is this problem that sometimes people can dismiss people in other parts of the country.
Yeah.
And country music is kind of a symbol of that. The Grand Ole Opry. I went there in Nashville. So it's a physical place, but it's also a radio show. And when I went, you know, the person on the tour said, you know, all of you grew up with memories of listening to the Grand Ole Opry in the radio and blah, blah, blah. And I don't have those memories. And apparently they don't broadcast to all 50 states.
Mm.
So for some people, the Grand Ole Opry is like a temple of country music.
Yeah.
And other people don't even know what it is.
Right.
And that just kind of shows how, of course, we are one nation and all these sorts of things, but there are these interesting regional differences. And country music, I think, shows the fault line there.
Yeah. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Have you ever done any country music covers?
I think so. On my computer, you can probably find some, you can probably find some recordings. A lot of them are baritones like me. George Strait, for example. I mean, I can sing a lot of his songs pretty well.
Yeah.
But I'd really have to work on it to get one that I felt like I owned.
Yeah.
You know, especially the ones that are talking about like the cowboy life. I got really into it during that year.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Like I had boots. I wore it with my suit, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's hard for me to really inhabit that authentically all the way down.
Yeah. Know, so. Yeah. Okay. So, Steve, what's your favorite chore?
So, like many of your guests, I don't really particularly like doing chores. Though I know one of your guests said, like, oh, all chores.
Jenny said that.
I noticed. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I think of them as being two kind of the same. One is organizing my wines. And the other one is organizing my books. So, you know, having these kind of discrete objects and categorizing them and bringing order to them. I love doing that.
How many books do you have?
I don't know. I'm trying to slowly bring my greatest hits down to DC.
Yeah.
So all the books that have been meaningful to me, slash the ones I've just bought. And then I have like a separate bookshelf by my desk for my law books.
Oh.
But that's kind of like not in the living room because I'd rather have in the living room Shakespeare's plays. And
Oh, you're definitely a bookworm.
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, wait, what's the first website you check in the morning?
A lot of them are like New York Times and Washington Post, things like that. But one that I've been reading a lot recently, and I'm checking almost daily now, is the 538's sports page.
Oh.
Because at the age of 33, my current age, I've suddenly gotten really into NFL football.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just like completely out of the blue. I'm like mesmerized by it.
Are you a Pats fan?
I'm a Pats fan. Yeah. Very proud to be one as well. Yeah. And I love 538's analysis. You know 538, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, instead of just reading some article where some guy's saying, well, you know, I think the Pats are due this weekend because they've had injuries, but the offensive line is back. They're actually rooting their analysis in statistics.
Yeah.
You know, so they did one saying that they think Carson Palmer is the MVP of the season so far. Mm-hmm. And they did it on this like huge analysis and like replacement value and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So that's my new go-to website.
Okay, so can you tell us about your morning and evening routines, like any rituals that you have?
So I've also gotten very into podcasts this year, ironically. I listen to the BBC News podcast every morning, but it's a little bit has that kind of Anglo bias. So I feel like there are a disproportionate number of stories about the UK, Egypt, Nigeria, these sorts of things. But so I also supplement with the NPR. NPR is like a 5-minute news podcast in the morning. So I always start with that, then go to BBC.
Yeah.
But my morning ritual is basically getting out of the apartment as quickly as I can so I can go somewhere to start writing. Because I distract myself when I'm in my own apartment. But if I'm in a coffee shop somewhere with a cup of coffee, I really feel like I can dial in for that hour and then go to work. So that's normally my morning routine. It's just get up and get out as quickly as possible so I don't lose any time.
Do you eat breakfast?
These days, I'm not having that much breakfast, actually. I just have some coffee and I eat at lunch. And you know, I think there's some new studies that are coming out that are supporting that more. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So people always used to say breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
Yeah.
But there are all these different things saying that's not necessarily the case. Also, your body, again, I'm not an expert, but I know everything on this podcast is fact. So I'm just going to.
I was just about to say that. I'm very impressed.
Exactly. So again, some studies, and I'm not a health professional, say that, you know, over the course of the 8 hours or however long that you're sleeping, your body becomes more effective at fat burning. So when you wake up in the morning and you're really not having that much to eat, your body is just kind of still in that state. Whereas if, by contrast, if you wake up in the morning and you have your instant oatmeal, again, that's like spiking your blood sugar and all those sorts of things. And your body just kind of goes in a different direction. So I've been a little less into the breakfast these days. And I think it's gone pretty well. So.
Oh, wow, that's really impressive that you wake up and then you write for an hour before going to work.
Yeah, people have told me that before. This is another thing. My grandfather is this way. My uncle, both my parents are morning people. And they get a lot done in the morning.
Yeah.
In contrast to others, my mind is at its sharpest the moment I wake up, and it decreases steadily throughout the day. That's, I know if I don't do it then, I'll like never do it.
Do you have any evening routines?
So I usually go to CrossFit, CrossFit DC again, and that's about an hour. I always have the same New Year's resolution every year that I'm going to try and inject some art into my daily life. So I'm always trying to do that. And usually that comes up at night. So for example, listening to this All Songs Considered podcast, I got about half a dozen albums from that. So I'm trying to like play that at night.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have a Kindle, which I like to read in the dark.
You do? You know that's supposed to make it hard for you to go to sleep.
So it isn't. It is interesting.
Are you going to tell me a study that is?
Well, so I think if you're looking at an iPad screen where the light is shining out at you, that's definitely the case. Amazon says, and who knows if this is true, that the light on the Kindle Paperwhite anyway kind of shines down on the screen. And I have noticed that it doesn't interrupt my sleep if I'll read a Kindle right before I go to bed. But if I have my iPhone screen up to my face right before I go to bed, it does affect my sleep. Somehow there's a difference there.
Yeah.
Maybe also because you can put the Kindle on very, very low light.
Yeah. So in line with my favorite op-ed article, Steve, can you tell us what is your best resume virtue and what is your best eulogy virtue?
Okay, so for resume, one of the things that I've kind of noticed is usually in interviews or whatever, people look at my resume and the first thing they say, they almost always say this is, you've done a lot. Again, in my kind of gut, I really feel like I'm young and I am young. But I think maybe that's something that pops out at people is they feel like I've had experiences. Again, I clerked here. I worked internationally for two different courts. I was a fellow at the American Society of International Law. And now I'm working for the U.S. government, Department of Justice. So,
and a professor.
Yeah, and I'm teaching now, right? Yeah. I'm teaching at Georgetown. So I think the resume virtue is that I've had different experiences that have kind of informed my perspective on the law.
Yeah.
In terms of eulogy virtues, my grandfather used to say, be broad like the sky. Mm. And the idea is, don't be too self-contained or be too finite. So if I passed away tomorrow and people were talking about my life, I think I'd like to hope that one of the things that they'd say, in addition to some of the other things we talked about, like I have enthusiasm for life, like my siblings, tried to live as broadly as possible, living in different countries and doing different things. And so now that I think about it, I guess the resume virtue and the eulogy virtue are kind of overlapping.
Yeah.
Either professionally or personally, just try and diversify, whether it's with a barbell or with a guitar or with, a legal brief.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Okay. And who is someone famous you would want to listen to this podcast episode?
Yeah, so
Steve has a big grin on his face right now. I'm very excited.
A musician named Priscilla Ahn, A-H-N is the last name. Mm-hmm. For two reasons. One is she's also half Korean. There was an article in the New York Times when I was in law school about how few Asian musical artists there are. So there's something, when I first discovered she was half Korean, I was like quite intrigued.
Yeah.
The other reason is because her music is just incredible. She's just totally unafraid to use her voice to just create beauty. And going back to what we were saying before about emotional sincerity in music, I mean, she just has these incredible songs. Mm. For example, one of them, she did a cover version of the Beatles' Julia. It's like a John Lennon song.
Yeah.
And she posted it to her YouTube with these clips of her travels in Asia. And she said the reason why she whipped the whole thing up in about 30 minutes is because the song was in her head. And she didn't have it on her computer, so she just decided to record it. And it's like this really delicate, but somehow very stirring version of the song.
Yeah.
So that's why I chose. I thought it tied in well with some of the things we'd be talking about today.
So. Well, Priscilla, this episode is dedicated to you. All right. So thanks for joining this episode of Personality with guest Stephen Coe. Hope that you all have a fantastic week and join us for next week's episode. And as always, let's talk awesome.